Welcome back to Season 9 of Talking with Traders. We're into the fifth year of this podcast that began in 2020. Once again, IG have come on board as the sponsor of the podcast. We're truly grateful to have such a global leader in online trading as our sponsors. In the coming weeks, I'll be interviewing various guests from around the globe on the topic of trading. Some of these will be past guests that we invite back onto the show, and some will be new guests. The idea is to attract a broad spectrum of different perspectives from various players in different areas of the markets. None of what you hear here is financial advice, but it is intended to get you thinking about how you might be able to apply what you hear here to your own trading and investing. Remember to subscribe to this podcast on your favorite podcast app. That way, you'll be notified when new episodes are released. Or if you watch these interviews on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel and give us a thumbs up and leave a comment if you wish. We welcome the engagement. Once again, thank you to IG for sponsoring this podcast into its fifth year, and thank you, listeners, for your continued support. Now, let's get on to this week's interview. This week's episode of Talking with Traders takes us to the east coast of Australia, to Brisbane. Our guest is Richard Brennan. He's the strategy ambassador for East Coast Capital Management. They have the accolade of best global macro and managed futures CTA in Australia in 2024. Richard, welcome to Talking with Traders.
Hi, Garth, and many thanks for bringing me on your podcast.
Well, it's a pleasure and it's a privilege to speak to you, and I'm really looking forward to this discussion, having looked at your bio and having followed some of the trades that you've done during this year, some fascinating success with some of the things that you've managed to capture. And we'll talk about your strategy and the way you approach the market during this discussion. But as I always do with new guests, can you just give us a little bit of a background to your career, like the 2-minute summary, if you can, of how you got to where you are now as the strategy ambassador for East Coast Capital Management?
Sure, Garth. So I first got involved in trading when I left university in about 1986. And I worked for a couple of decades for a listed Australian company over here, which was what we call a responsible entity, and that's like a trustee structure. And under ASIC guidelines, there are regulator over here to offer retail funds to the public, you need to operate under a responsible entity. They're basically the company which the investment managers click into. So working for the responsible entity, I was the CFO of that company and also got involved in the compliance side of looking at the funds that were clicking into our network. And that gave me exposure to a lot of different trading styles. And so from there, I started commencing my sort of in earnest trading stocks using value investing techniques. And that went for about a period of 5 or 10 years with, you know, ups and downs, periods of success. And then I got involved with options and also in a term we call spread trading those stocks. Yeah. So I'd be long and short particular stocks, particularly in the Australian stock market, looking at relative outperformance of one stock over another stock and trading the spread. From that point in time, that led me up to about 2012, where I stepped out with a few of my colleagues who I'd worked with previously, and we set up a fund for a couple of years, which was a bit of an unsuccessful venture. At that point in time, we're sort of exposing ourselves to derivatives trading, particularly CFDs and indexes and the Australian indexes over here. That's when in about 2014, I decided to go back to ground zero and jump on the shoulders of the very successful fund managers, and decided that given my track record up to that point in time was fairly volatile and was not what I call sustainable for the long term, I decided to see what the best in class were doing globally. And that's where I latched on to trend following, or diversified systematic trend following. And that's where I've basically been ever since.
Okay, very interesting. So now, I mean, tell me about the type of trading you do. I know that the sort of title that I'm thinking about for this podcast is going to be pushing into the fat tail or something along those lines. It's an interesting approach to trading that I want you to just give us a bit more color on that, and we'll get into the nuts and bolts of it. But yeah, the type of strategy that you do where you are now, and what's made it successful, particularly this year, 2024.
Sure. So, look, in my research that I did of the best in the world, basically, I realized that most of them were relying on a handful of trades, these huge magnitude trades, which account for predominantly 90 to 100% of their success over time. You know, we see Warren Buffett with a few of his classic trades in Coca-Cola and these sort of stocks, which he attributes to basically the success of Berkshire Hathaway. And I realized that the successful moments in trades is it's dominated by a few very successful trades. And that therefore steered me away from the normal machinations of the market to look at the particular market movers that offered these significant potential moves in the market, which therefore attracted me to this approach called diversified systematic trend following. So, with this approach, what we're doing is we're keeping away from what I call the normal market machinations, the mean reversion inverting qualities of markets, the noise that exists in the markets, and only getting involved or participating in the markets when we get these signals arising at what I call the edges of the normal distribution, where from that point on they either go to the left or right of the normal distribution into what I call the tail environments of the distribution. It's in those particular environments we get these extreme moves, and but also we get a chaotic volatility. So it requires a particular approach that I believe has an edge in this market, because I notice that about 90% of traders focus on the typical normal market machinations, mean reverting properties, the progressive sort of the daily churn of the markets. And that's something I wanted to keep away from. And it's also something that I believe as we go into the future is going to be intensely competitive, even more than it is now, with things like AI, pattern recognition, all of these things coming into that zone. So I wanted to steer clear of that and go into these chaotic areas of the distribution of returns, where AI doesn't have an edge in that context, and it requires a particular approach to really sort of restrict your adverse volatility in those areas, but allow for open upside potential. And in these particular tail regions, where trends become what I call very enduring in nature, might last 4, 5 years, 6 years, etc. That's the area I wanted to be in, because I thought, one, there's not much competition in that particular zone. People try to keep away from that. So if you could imagine that the tail properties of the market are usually the causes of the major grief for the majority of traders. There are instances like the 2008 GFC, where we got this massive tail move in the stock markets, COVID, all of these things. So when we get these events occurring, we get these massive moves, it's usually crippling for the traders that are trading against that crisis event. What we're doing with our models is we're looking to capitalize on those events, because once we jump onto these, what we call these material trends, our hope is that they crystallize into these enduring features that persist for a long period of time. And we just ride an ensemble of very simple trend following models to capitalize on that endurance that exists in those areas.
Okay, super. So I know in our in our introductory discussion the other day, you referred to this approach as sort of hunting outliers. I like that term. And if we think about outliers, we think about like when oil went negative a few years ago. That's clearly an outlier move. We've had cocoa this past year and last year, which has been on a tear, gone up several hundreds of percent. Orange juice futures. There are others, and I know we're going to talk about these because some of these are trades that you've managed to catch and actually ride those waves. But what I'm curious about is what properties do you see that kind of alerts you to these things? Cocoa, for example, was going sideways for a very long time. Looked like exactly what you were referring to as that mean reversion type trade. It was just in a range going up and down and up and up. Then, all of a sudden it broke out of that range. And yes, there were fundamental causes for it. There was a crop failure in West Africa where a lot of cocoa comes from and what have you. So there's some fundamentals there. But what sort of things are you looking at in your data and the criteria that alerts you to the possibility that one of these outlier moves is coming?
Sure. So, Garth, we do intensive research with our modeling that we apply. So, what we do before we introduce a market into our portfolio, we'll look at a very long-term data set of that particular market. It might be, as much data as we can get. And then we plot that to see whether it exhibits these tail properties. So, to become an entrant into our universe, we need a market that is sufficiently liquid and doesn't express possibilities for significant adverse slippage. So they've got to meet liquidity requirements, but also they've got to have fat tails in that data. Now, what we notice is that nearly all of the data sets, I haven't found a data set yet that doesn't express those fat tail properties. And coming from the old theories that dominated economics, the efficient market hypothesis, where they assumed that the normal distribution dominated the bulk of the distribution of returns, that clearly didn't account for these tail properties that were seen so frequently but couldn't be accounted by the normal distribution. So, for instance, in the stock market alone, the S&P 500. I think the probabilities of what we call a five standard sigma event, or in other words, five standard deviation move, was about one in 3.2 million chance, which means that one day out of 3.2 million days, according to a normal distribution, we get a five sigma event. But we've had over 60 of them in the last 30 years.
Wow.
So it clearly says to me that the efficient market hypothesis significantly underestimates the propensity of markets to exhibit these tail properties. And what I do find is that there are alternate theories such as complex adaptive systems, etc., which do account for these what we call outliers. Now, the reason the term outliers is used is that most people treat them as anomalies. And therefore, the way they treat them when they're examining their data is they tend to exclude these anomalies because they have such a dominating influence on their models that they say, right, they're anomalies, so I'll exclude them, and then I'll undertake my process of modeling without the influence of those outliers. What we say is, no, they're essential parts of the market structure exhibited in all complex adaptive systems, a bit like what I call transition events. So if we could imagine these complex adaptive systems evolving over time, the classic case of what I call a transition event is when we in physics look at the change from ice to water to gas. Between those regimes, the ice to water to gas, there's a transition event where the structure is totally changed. Now, outliers exist in those transition events. So that accounts for these significant magnitude moves that have never been experienced in the backtest record for significant periods of time. They're basically what exists between regimes. So if we could imagine the financial markets as exhibiting occasional equilibrium properties and occasional what I call divergent properties, you can basically separate your market regimes, and the separators are these transition events. That's where the outliers exist. So, even though they're a lot less frequent than what we experience in the backtest, my models avoid the normal market machinations. So, with cocoa, for example, it had many, many years of mean reverting behavior. My models were inactive, but they were ready to pounce once it broke out of that behavior. Because the way I tested my cocoa was that I don't just test on one market, I test on all markets in my entire portfolio to ensure that they had this universal property to capture outliers. So we're not looking for what I call patterns that are specific to individual markets. I'm looking for these outliers that are what I think are universal qualities found in all liquid markets, and I'm therefore deliberately turning off my strategies during the normal everyday market machinations, and they only become active when we get these significant breakouts that are beyond statistically what we find is common for the market. That therefore pushes my trade activity out to the tail regions, so I don't participate in what I call the bulk of the distribution of returns. I'm only starting to participate when trends start getting material in nature, either long or short. So, for example, for cocoa, my systems were dormant, but maybe one system might be triggered or another system might be triggered, you know, 6 months later. But when these material outliers occur, because I trade an ensemble of models, and that is imperative for these chaotic features. When I trade an ensemble of models, one system comes in, but it stays in because we get a magnificent price acceleration. Then another model might come in, and as the trend endures, I get increased commitment with my models as that trend endures. But if it goes down and meets my trailing stops, I'm out, and then my models need to get active again, etc. So that's the way I'd trade cocoa and all of the other outliers I trade.
Right. Okay. So it's interesting because, I mean, as you pointed out, you know, these outliers are exactly that. They're outliers. If one thinks of a bell curve of distributions, you know, most of the activity happens in the large part of the bell, and then there's the thin end of the wedge on either side, and that's what you're looking to try and capture. But as you pointed out, the market spends most of its time in this sort of chaotic type of a regime, where it mean reverts and there's presumably nothing to do on your models. These tail events don't come around every day. They're infrequent by nature. So, I mean, I presume then that your returns must be fairly lumpy in the money that you manage. You're not, you know, I'm thinking of an equity curve that sort of has these fast moves up, but then can sit and go nowhere sideways, or perhaps even slight drawdowns for lengths of, you know, significant lengths of time until the next big breakout type of move comes along.
That's exactly right. If we look at each individual market, that's how they behave. So we get what we call, when we do catch an outlier, you get a step up in your equity curve. But when you're during the, what I call the equilibrium or the regime state of a market, where it settles into a regime where mean reversion noise dominates, you get stagnation or building drawdowns on that individual market. Now, the key to our entire process is maximum diversification across markets and maximum diversification using our uncorrelated systems. The whole reason we're doing that is to stop it being so lumpy. As you say, if we're looking at the individual market level, they are very lumpy. And for instance, anyone who saw the individual equity curve of one of the markets we trade wouldn't be interested as a trader. They'd say to themselves, well, that looks intensely volatile and not much return offered there. But the way this all comes together is at the portfolio level, when you bring together these hundreds of return streams that have these step-ups and these stagnation periods and these drawdowns. Now, provided they're all uncorrelated, providing we're trading uncorrelated return streams, all of these step-outs up start amalgamating and over the course of time, so they're not all concentrated in one location. And so we get this very strong uplift in the entire portfolio equity curve attributed through the compounding associated with many, many outliers over the course of time. But all of the adversity associated with that portfolio is limited by our techniques of risk management, where we apply very small bets to each individual trade and stop losses to each individual trade, which reduce this portfolio risk. It creates an escape valve for the return stream in the portfolio.
Okay, so yeah, that kind of leads me to my next question is, you know, I'm guessing with this type of strategy, you know, it's always easy in retrospect to look back and see when a big outlier event happened. But of course, you're trying to anticipate that or get on board in an early stage of one of these things. But I'm guessing then that you must have plenty of false starts. You know, you've got to kiss a lot of frogs before you find the prince, as it is, right? So what is your sort of win to loss ratio on your trades historically?
So for the fund that I'm looking after, we look at it on a month by month basis. So about 62% of our months are winners. with the balance being losers.
Right.
And we have around a 1.7 times to 2 times payoff ratio. Wins are about 2 times our losses, which are 1 time. That's for the fund. But for the CFDs that I also offer as a trading strategy, we're having about a 40% win rate with our CFDs, but I've got a much higher payoff ratio of around 2.7 average win to loss. There are two different processes involved there. We've got less system diversification in our fund because that trades futures, and when you trade futures, you require a much greater capital allocation.
Right.
But in the world of CFDs, where we get access to micro lots, it allows us to get extensive diversification there, where I can deploy more aggressively my systems in that environment. But there are trade-offs in the CFD world versus the futures world, in terms of the costs of the instruments you're trading and those sort of things. So
Right. Okay. All right. Super. I'm going to re refer the listeners to your website, and we'll actually include this in the show notes, a link to it, because on your website you've got a beautiful video which illustrates some of the trades that you've managed to capture in the last year, which have made 2024 such a successful year. But if I can just sort of try my best to describe it, it's quite a satisfying video to watch, because essentially what your video does is it builds the charts of these instruments. Let's use cocoa as the example, but I mean, you've also got orange juice futures there. I think you've got a pound trade there. There's Bitcoin is another one. But essentially the chart builds. So it's obviously it's clearly sped up, right? But the chart builds over time, and you see this basically this rising line into the top right corner of the page as the price of the instrument rises exponentially, as was the case with cocoa. But what's particularly interesting is it shows each of your entry points, and then it joins the entry point to the current price with like a string, and it shows variety of different entry points along the price chart, which then end up connecting like guitar strings, in a sense, to the current price action. And I hope I'm describing it in a way that's going to at least entice the audience to go and watch the video. It's a 7-minute video, and it's really interesting to watch it. And we'll put the link to it in the show notes. But the question I'm coming to from this is that you've got to run your winners to be able to capture these big moves. And that is one of the hardest things to do in trading, especially when you get a very big move like you do in for example, cocoa. It's gone up several hundreds of percent off the breakout, but there have also been some pretty serious pullbacks along the way. Now, I find it very hard to run a winner to that extent. I had a guest on my podcast years ago. His name's James Gubb, South African guy, and he had a great term for this. He said, "You have to be a what did he say? You need guts to be a greedy pig." That was his quote, and I loved it.
Yes.
It's always kind of stuck with me. As I watched these videos of yours, watching these big trends unfold, and how you were able to run the winners up the right-hand side of the page, it got me thinking of exactly that. I mean, it must take guts to hold that through all of that ups and downs. How do you manage to stay on a trend without it throwing you off?
Okay, so there's a couple of good points here. So the first is we don't treat any individual trade as significant because we apply a very small bet for that individual trade. So our whole process is looking at the next 2,000, 3,000 trades. So an individual trade to us is insignificant. By looking at it that way, we don't therefore we're not always looking at our screen. We're just letting this our systems play out. So these are all algorithmic based systems that are just ticking away, and we avoid the noise of news. We step away from the screens, and we just have confidence in our process. So to have confidence in your process, you need to have developed it yourself. And it needs to be extensive. There's a long period of time to train yourself to become less committed to each individual trade, but having total faith in the philosophy of your trend following, in your process, your workflow process, your backtest results, what you're seeing from how this is being applied in out-of-sample data. It builds a level of confidence to make you realize that I've just got to let the system make its decisions. I cannot afford for my discretionary brain to try and override those decisions. So the whole reason we are deploying a systematic process is, well, twofold. One is there is no way our brain could manage so many trades at any one point in time. And two is we know that the brain itself is going to try and circumvent our decision, our rules-based decision making that our systems, at the research of our systems and our extensive testing have demonstrated, because our brains have evolved in a different environment to these markets. So in our environment we've involved in, it's important to us to act on instinct, important to us to act on where we see someone holding up a stick and we might see it's a gun. All of these things are fear or greed responses through our evolution in a different environment. When we're in the markets, we're not trading in the same environment we evolved in. We're trading against some of the cleverest people alive on this planet who are also involved in this market. So we can't use our evolutionary brain to try and attempt to steer us in the right direction. It's going to let us down. We must have a quantitative rules-based process that circumvents the brain. Another important reason, Garth, that we can stay on our winners is we've got a particular approach we use to avoid us looking at what I call the unrealized equity. So if you could imagine, if we're trading cocoa and we've built up these significant material profits that haven't been realized yet, they're still in our P&L, they haven't been realized, we're not looking at them because that's not the metric we're looking at to look at our performance. What we're looking at is what we call the realized balance, the closed trades of our portfolio. Because if you imagine the way we apply our process is we're taking these individual bets with the hope that they have massive payoffs. So that's what I call we need the baseball bat analogy to swing for the fences. We've got to allow maximum freedom for us to ride these outliers because we can never predict or anticipate how long or whether it's going to turn into an outlier and how long it's going to last. So we must be prepared to risk a significant amount of capital, but it's not what I call realized capital we're risking. It's our unrealized capital. So as our profits build, we're not looking at, oh, how much profit have I currently made now that's sitting unrealized, because that's what we're using to swing for the fences. And if you look at the risk return relationship, you always need to take higher risk to get higher returns. And in our world of the outliers, the risk that we're allocating, even though the initial trade we put on was a very small bet in relation to our realized capital, but then over the course of time it built. And because we're still in the trade, it was still unrealized, but now it had built up a significant profit. That is unrealized profit. That is the necessary risk we're taking to swing the bat wide for these potential events that could last many, many years. So some of the outliers that we've been able to capture, amount to say 120 times R. In other words, R is the initial bet size we put on, and some of them last for a single trade 120 R. They are monster trades, might last 3 or 4 years, 5 years. Some of them were in cocoa, some of them were in orange juice. There's outliers that exist all over our diversified portfolio, but because they're such chaotic anomalies, people aren't seeing them as outliers. They're seeing them as when they look at them, they're looking at all of the machinations of the price movements over the course of the last 4 years. They're saying that's not a clear trend. That's a very messy, chaotic movement. But because we apply these models with what I call very loose pants, that is an outlier to us. And we're also swinging the bat high. We're risking a lot of capital to stay on these things. So the worst thing we can do is keep our eye on the daily movements of the P&L, because that will once again allow our brain to say, take that profit off the table. And I don't do that. So I close my screen off and just do not look at it. The only thing I'm looking at is month by month performance, maybe, 500 trades, 700 trades, 1,000 trades. That's the thing you've got to focus on if you want to trade with this particular process.
It's really interesting. It takes me back to think of a client that I once had in my broking days, and he effectively rode the trend up in the South African equity market between 2004 and 2008. And if you go back and look at it, it was a pretty linear upward trend. And he clearly wasn't applying the kind of quantitative and methodical methods that you do. I think he was a bit lucky in retrospect, but he caught that trend and rode it, and he 50x'd his account by doing kind of what you said, like buying futures, holding, using the unrealized gains to fund more purchases, building the position, and always leaving enough margin to be able to carry the drawdowns. And he did see some pretty ugly drawdowns along the way, but he was exactly what I said. He had the guts to be the greedy pig. The trouble was that eventually the game ended and the financial crisis happened, and at that point he was so heavily long, and it all came tumbling down in a matter of months, and lost everything. So went from 50x'd his account, and then took it back to nothing. And there's a disaster story in the end. So I guess I'm sort of thinking back to that, but also thinking, how do you avoid the end of that story so that you catch the 50x times your initial risk, but you don't, you're not still stuck around holding the bag when it all eventually ends.
So all of our strategies, every one of them, have a trailing stop associated with them. So it's the trailing stop that basically converts the unrealized equity into realized balance over the course of time. So if you could imagine, when we first place a trade, we might have a particular realized capital balance of all of our trades at that point in time. We'll assign a very small risk bet, say 0.25% of that total realized balance would be our initial bet size. So very small bets. But then we might apply 10 different ensemble models to it. So where we've sort of totally maximized out with the use of these systems for a particular market, we might have 10 models engaged at 0.25%. So therefore, there's a total risk exposure there of 2.5%. So even that level alone shows that we can address these outliers with very minimal capital exposure. And so we have this trailing stop associated post-entry, either long or short, that just means that we're not giving back all of that profit when the trend ends. And for instance, cocoa, which had a significant run-up in April, also had a big retracement in April. Our trailing stops were sufficiently gave sufficient breathing room to accommodate that without knocking out all of our ensemble of trades. So many stayed in,
Okay, so some were
but
stopped out, but not all of them is what you're saying.
that's right. And
Okay.
this is why, if you can imagine, when you're trading chaotic systems, and the good thing is, let's look at things like the tracking of cyclones or hurricanes. What they use in meteorology is ensemble-based models to basically track that chaotic anomaly. So what the ensemble does, what the ensemble does is it says, I will apply 100 different models that attempt to define the trajectory of that particular hurricane in the future, and I'll use a frequentist approach to say, if some of the tracks of the individual models diverge widely, that therefore creates a bigger possible location where that hurricane's going to land on the land surface. So when they diverge widely with an ensemble, that tells you it's a very chaotic system. When they converge and it's very precise where they're going to be located, and all of the ensemble models are converging on a known location, it's a very precise estimate. This is how we view applying these ensemble models with the tail properties in these chaotic regions. Some of them might diverge widely. That means that many systems might be knocked out over the course of time. Some might stay in for the long ride. Those that were sufficiently gave sufficient breathing room and had sufficient in their system configuration was able to ride that entire trajectory. But with these chaotic trends, some of them knock out quite a few systems. But when you're trading on ensemble, you're not getting all of your systems knocked out. So if you imagine, if I trade one trend following system, the system itself defines constraints within which price needs to move to stay in that trade. So therefore, every system has constraints embedded in it, which forces a particular trajectory. This means if you have a very simple system, which has very, what I call, lots of breathing room, so the constraints are very wide, it gives maximum freedom for price to move. That's one system. When I apply a different system with different constraints, still with what I call loose pants, it applies a different trajectory to that particular trend. So if I'm applying an ensemble of 10 trend following models, I'm giving 10 different possible trajectories for that outlier to head towards. And each one of them is defining the trend differently. So my systems define the trend, not me, not my brain.
Right.
So my systems and the constraints say, this is the trend for this particular design system. When it hits a trailing stop for that system, the trend is over for that system. It might still be on for the other systems. So if you could imagine, my ensembles are all defining trend differently to give maximum possible freedom for the future trajectory, to offer chaotic properties but big enduring potential. That's the way you must apply when you're trading in the tail regions, in the chaotic zone. You need an ensemble, otherwise you're not going to get anywhere with a single system.
Right. Okay. All right. Very good. Now, of course, I've been bringing, this is kind of like the crescendo question of this discussion, which I'm sure probably a lot of listeners are waiting for as well, is in terms of big breakouts. We are right now, we've just seen an enormous breakout in Bitcoin and a lot of the cryptocurrencies. So is that ticking all the boxes in terms of one of these potentially huge moves that's coming into the top right-hand corner of the page? I mean, I know Bitcoin already has had a big run if we zoom out, but yeah, in terms of 2024, it spent 8 months consolidating sideways, and now it's just recently broken to a new high above $75,000. And as we sit here right now, I think it's about 88,000 this morning. It's had a very strong move, mostly thanks to Donald Trump's election victory, I suppose. but that, you know, to my naive eye, looks like an enormous breakout, and potentially, you know, is on the road to being one of these big outlier moves.
Yes, Garth. So fortunately, that video, hopefully you can refer people to, shows how we've been trading that Bitcoin up until a few days ago. I basically updated that about 5 days ago.
Right.
Ever since December 2022, we've pretty well been long Bitcoin. There was a big period in 2024, you know, March through to July 2024, where it was sideways moving, basically within a consolidation phase. So that nailed most of our systems, all of our systems. So we had about 10 active by the time it started reaching that hiatus of that first move. And then subsequent to that, we had a few shorts that unfortunately failed over that particular period. But then with the recent breakout, which occurred back in, a couple of months ago, it started breaking out. We progressively got more and more involved in Bitcoin. So now we are slowly building our positions in Bitcoin. And on that video, they'll see where we're at as at, you know, 4 or 5 days ago. So that's right. So we have no preconception of whether it's going to be an outlier. Our systems are doing all the work for us. At the moment, there's three systems that have said to itself, that's a sufficient signal for me to jump on board. The systems have done their work, three of them. There's seven more systems idly sitting out there saying, nah, don't participate yet, waiting. So if this transpires to go through the roof, progressively more and more of these systems will activate and will get more and more concentrated in Bitcoin, with the trailing stops all riding up behind it. So that's how we're dealing with that.
Right. Okay. Super. I know when we did our intro chat the other day before this recording, you mentioned that you had tried various different types of trading over the years, and you said you weren't so successful with the fund in 2012, etc. And I'm always brought back to this point about finding a style of trading that fits your personality. Do you therefore find that this style of trading fits your personality, that you're seeking those outliers? Is that a fair question to ask?
That is a fair question, and I'd like to go against the grain here, because there's a lot of people that say it's best to if you're bored, that means you're trading well. So in my world of outliers, what I love doing is waking up in the morning and finding that something's done 10x, 20x, or something like that on the prior day's move. There is nothing more elating to me than seeing these outliers in action. So if you can imagine, I'm not interested in the small movements. Say I yawn and I get bored with small movements. But with massive movements, they're the things that make my day. The way I understand this is, in all systems we've got in this world, the complex systems offer what they call this Pareto distribution. And I think that, that accounts for why the top five stocks in the S&P 500 dominate the entire performance of the entire S&P 500. This Pareto effect is that what drives the huge moves is a handful, 5%, 10% of the total distribution. That's what I'm interested in. If, for instance, you apply for value investing, and all of the different techniques I applied before was never dealing with these outliers. In fact, all of the systems I was applying before had what I call negative skew and what I call warehoused risk built into them. In other words, when you start putting together a portfolio of different return streams together, there is the risk you see in the back test, which is explicit, and it can be explained by things like the Sharpe ratio and volatility measures like standard deviation. But that doesn't account for the total risk that exists in that portfolio. Every single trade in that portfolio bears the risk of total failure of all of those individual trades. So if you are trading 1,000 return streams, there is 1,000 possible risk events which summated together brings you to risk of ruin at the portfolio level. So every portfolio carries this warehouse risk potential. With the prior strategies I was trading, they all had this warehouse risk and negative skew, which meant that it would take me years to get ahead, but then overnight in a few months, I'd experience these wicked losses that would wipe out all of those hard years. So the profile there was totally inappropriate for my personality. What I like to do is I like to say I'm prepared to endure whipsaws or moments of small losses for a long period of time, knowing that one day I'm going to wake up and know that all of them are going to be taken care of. And there's the famous Ed Sakota banjo song, which he did, where he talks about one good trade or one good trend pays for them all. And that's exactly how I like to view my trading. I like the opportunity that my risk is always mitigated. So my adverse risk, I must trade in what I call a positive skewed environment. I must account for all of the risk in my portfolio, all of the warehouse risk in my portfolio, account for that possibility, and but allow then for unlimited upside potential, because I know, with my understanding of how markets behave, they're chaotic and they can do incredible things that none of us can predict in advance. I must have a strategy or a portfolio that can take advantage of that without any predictive hindsight. I must have a process that can take advantage of the fat tails in a beneficial way as opposed to an adverse way.
And last question, perhaps second last question, and I think I know what you're probably going to say to this, but do you find trading stressful? Does this approach stress you out or not?
Not anymore. I've been in this game now for a very, very long time, and I certainly can tell you it was stressful until I came onto this process in 2014. From that period of time on, because my entire game is about risk management. It's about taking care of the risk, and the profits naturally take care of themselves. No hands, mum. I'm not sort of predicting anything here. All I'm doing is I'm allowing the market to deliver my profits, but I'm mitigating my risk at all time. So with that mindset, that philosophy, now I can sleep well at night because I'm only ever risking a very small bet on my realized capital. I'm not looking at the screen, looking at that unrealized capital. I'm looking at, oh dear, I've lost, thousands of dollars on my cocoa trade because it's up so high. I don't think that way. And I suppose the processes that you learn over the course of time and listening to some of the great people you've had on your podcast, Garth, like Tom Basso, Lawrence Bensdorp, all of these people, they'll tell you that, Mr. Serenity, for instance, good old Tom Basso, once you understand and have a total commitment in your philosophy and approach, and you've taken care of tied off all the loose ends of your risk weaknesses in your portfolio, you can afford to sleep well at night, and you know that the market's going to deliver something crazy down the track, which is going to be a beneficial crazy to you, not an adverse crazy to you.
Excellent. Super. Well, I said that was the second last question. The last one really is how can listeners to this podcast follow your work? Is your fund available for listeners to invest in? Although we're not selling financial advice here, but if that is a possibility. And I know you also have a podcast, don't you? So yeah, I'm happy to talk about that as well. And maybe we cross-pollinate audiences a bit here.
Yeah, definitely. So here are the ways you can get me is on Twitter. So that's at RichB118. You can get me on LinkedIn. Just looking for Richard Brennan. Probably put Richard Brennan Trader, and it'll pick me up. At my website, which is ATS Trading Solutions, that focuses on the CFD world, using these diversified systematic trend following processes, but for retail traders who don't have the capital requirements to trade in the futures space, we've got the solution in CFDs that can at least teach them the appropriate techniques and give them the necessary training wheels to build their capital to a point where then, once they've got sufficient capital, they'd slip over to futures trading, for instance, using these processes. East Coast Capital Management is available to wholesale investors, so not unfortunately not to retail investors, but you can get us there at eccm.com.au. I'm also a co-originator of the Aussie Turtles, which is looking at bringing the turtles trading experiment globally into Australia. And so we work closely with Jerry Parker and Marit Siebert from Takahi Capital and ourselves at East Coast Capital Management. And we've got big plans for that next year. So you can get us on Aussie Turtles there at aussieturtles.au, but soon it's going to be aussieturtles.com. The podcast, of course, you can get me on the Algorithmic Advantage, which is a podcast here in Australia with Simon Mansell, which we interview some of the people you've had on your program, Garth, and we love meeting with these people. So that's at the Algorithmic Advantage. And finally, you can also catch me occasionally on the Top Traders Unplugged series with Niels Kastrup-Larsen, the Systematic Investor series. So I'm there sort of periodically every 2 or 3 months on that podcast as well.
That's fantastic. Plenty of places to get all of you there then. Well, that's it. So I'm going to wrap it up there, Richard. It's been really enjoyable and really insightful chatting to you. There's quite a unique approach to the markets that you've got, which is very interesting to talk about and listen to the way you do it. And just to reiterate to the audience, go and watch that video, the 7-minute video, which we'll link to in the show notes, which kind of shows the way a trade is built up and how you run the winners. It's quite satisfying to watch, actually.
Yes.
So,
Thanks very much for having me, Garth.
yeah,
Yeah.
Richard Brennan in Brisbane, Australia. Thank you very much for your time. It's been a pleasure speaking to you, and I hope we can keep in contact.
Definitely, Garth. Thanks very much.
Thanks. Thanks for joining us for this week's episode of Talking with Traders, sponsored by IG, a world-leading CFD provider. We really are privileged to have such a strong global provider of online trading services as our backer for this podcast series. Remember to subscribe for more episodes by clicking on the subscribe button of your favorite podcast app. Or if you're watching on YouTube, please subscribe to our YouTube channel, give us a thumbs up, and leave a comment. We welcome the engagement. Till next time.